Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Looky, here we are. It is the 7th day of August, 2014. It's a Thursday. That makes it Thorn in the Side Thursday here at the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is, of course, our home. That's where you go to jump right into the chat room, among other things. Folks wandering by already, and you are more than welcome to join in. Thank you very much, Randy. Loud and clear on iTunes on my Mac, says Randy. Thank you. And thanks also go out to Randy for some technical help recently, replacing one of our cooked. Thanks, Appalachian Power and your coal-fired majesty. One of our cooked, uninterruptible power supplies. Oh, brother, I've started something now. Texas T in the chat room. Howdy, Bob, you Mesoamerican model. Oh, jeez. Folks wandering into the chat room, indefatigable, inveterate chat room moderator Sparky is in the room this evening, as well as is Jan R. and M. Brandt and Texas T. More folks will be wandering by, I have no doubt. It's not like we have to, you know, cattle prod people into the chat room. No, not at all. And if you've never been to the chat room, jump in. It is a whale of a good time. It's a full, just multimedia experience, folks cussing and discussing alongside the program. Yes, how could I forget? It's not just Dan in the chat room. It's Jerry there, too. Hey, Jerry. I wonder how many times we'll say the same thing at the same time this evening. That happens a lot for Jerry and me. Funny how that is. No, coincidences, yeah, what Texas T was talking about was just a little funsy thing that I posted on my Facebook page earlier. And no, it can't really put it on, no, can't put it on the website. And I didn't tweet it either. This is just on Facebook. So here's how it works out. Today, and you know, wonderful things like this happen all the time. Because people, I talk about things that matter to me, and people then in turn notice things along their way and go, hey, I want Bob to see this. And so I went to the mailbox earlier today, and you may recall our buddy Tom in the Bay Area of California wrote us a note on the passing of his mother recently, talking about what a brilliant woman she had been. And no doubt was. Well, he also had a brilliant aunt who was very much involved in cataloging a great number of what are referred to as pre-Columbian, which I think we got to find a better term than that, pre-Native American Holocaust, pre-arrival of predatory white people. Anyway, artworks, particularly sculpture and ceramic from the period prior to 1492. It's a magnificent book based upon a museum exhibit that Tom's aunt worked on. And the cover of it just grabbed me because it's this, I presume, a royal figure. The book was written before the Mayan glyphs were fully translated, so I don't know who this guy is, but we probably do know now, and I'm going to try to do some research and find out. But it's a sculpture from a frieze I presume, F-R-I-E-Z-E. And the guy's sitting cross-legged and looking off to his right. He's got a little goatee, got a little mustache. Got a great updo. But I looked at it, and first of all, I was amazed with the book, and then I thought of something, and that is this. When we were shooting the mountaintop removal footage with MSNBC, Ferg and I, we were all over the place. One of the places we naturally went, because it's one of the few places where you can actually look out and see the reality at eye level of mountaintop removal, is Cayford Mountain, which sits on the boundary of Kanawha, Boone, and I think Raleigh, or maybe Fayette counties. And in a during a break, I just plopped myself down in the at the top of what's left of the mountain, and was sitting there. And without knowing it, Ferg was taking pictures. I turned him loose with the 35mm DSLR, and he did a really good job. Most of the photographs that you've been seeing on Facebook are Ferg's work. So he grabs, he shoots this candid shot of me sitting there in the weeds. And when I saw this, when I saw the cover of this magnificent book, I went, "Whoa, what?" And so, consequently, it is there now on the Facebook page, and it's you know, like I said on the post, it's just for fun. But dadgum, if there's not a, okay, so I outweigh the guy in the sculpture by probably 100 pounds, and I don't have the fabulous coiffure that he does, but the pose and everything, surprisingly similar. So that's what Texas Tea was talking. Now, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. I always forget that part. I am, indeed. And, of course, also at the website, headonradionetwork.com, I got all wrapped up in talking about the chat room. But you'll also find there the pop-out player that's super easy to utilize if you're just sitting around a PC or a laptop or some such. And it's right there for you. We're working on a new content program, loading that, John Fox is, and hopefully it'll, we'll be putting a little more content up there in coming weeks. But the player is there for you if you want to avail yourself of it. If you're listening on some sort of smart device, iThis or Android that, we recommend the apps from either Stitcher or TuneIn Radio, in which case they both work equally well. The bot version cuts out the ads. On the other hand, if you want to do the free version, the light version, you're going to put up with some ads. But please remember, I don't say this idly, please remember that none of the ads that run on those apps in any way support whatsoever the horn, or this nearly 10-year-old internet-based effort to create independent broadcasting. No, hell no. No, this effort is driven entirely by your determination that this effort should continue. Now, we pulled up a mite short last night in fundraising, so we're around $250 to get the job done this evening, this thorn in the side Thursday, and not finish the week in a hole tomorrow. So, you know, 25 folks, 10 bucks a piece, whatever it takes. Hopefully the hole won't get too terribly deep. Occasionally it does. But you know where the PayPal button is. If you click the tab contribute, you'll also find the traditional United States Postal Service address for the horn. And if you choose to go that route, which is fine, because Boss Man Wayne always enjoys not having to put on his spider-proof gloves when he reaches into the mailbox. And thanks, by the way, to Captain Mary for a beautiful, beautiful note that Boss Man Wayne shared with me last weekend. Probably share it with you at some point. But if you're going to go that route, just remember, don't make anything payable to Bob Kincaid, because Bob Kincaid doesn't see the money. Bob Kincaid doesn't know. Boss Man Wayne takes care of the bills, and he puts it in the account and everything. So stuff should be made payable to Head-On Communications or the Horn or what have you. Huddy-duddy, huddy-duddy. No, it really is thorn in the side Thursday. We reserve those for things that make us go, "Dope!" And it was aptly named by our good buddy Horst. Since we couldn't have feather in our caps Friday, thorn in the side Thursday comes from the thorn in the side list of the Hornet. Comes from Catch 22. Everything's got a reference around here. And so, with that in mind, I sit there doing show prep and reading this and contemplating that, and yeah, this will work. No, this isn't worth the time. Hey, look at that. Oh, my God, look at that. Oh, please, really? Another toddler? That kind of thing. That's any given day around here. And so usually I've got a pretty good idea of where the program's going to go in terms of the filibobster by airtime. But every now and then, you just sort of, I don't know, you're sitting there and the thorn, you don't have to go to the thorns will come to you and just, ow! From the New York Times, at 5:18 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 53 minutes ago, American forces said to bomb ISIS targets in Iraq. Really? August was already that boring? Elisa Rubin at the New York Times has the story, Dateline Dohuk, Iraq, D-O-H-U-K. American military forces bombed at least two targets in northern Iraq on Thursday night to rout Islamist insurgents who have trapped tens of thousands of religious minorities in Kurdish areas, Kurdish officials said. Word of the bombings reported on Kurdish television from the city of Erbil came as President Obama was preparing to make a statement in Washington. I don't know if he has yet made that statement. Maybe somebody can update. But that particular, I first learned about this, catching up last night after airtime, catching up with my favorite blogger out there on the interweb tubes, Mr. Charlie Pierce, over at Esquire.com/blogs/politics. In other words, the Esquire Politics blog by Charles Pierce, in which for the first time in my life I heard of a people called the Yazidi. And they are among those who were trapped in Iraq and being starved out and otherwise besieged by the ISIS monsters. And that's not just a throwaway word, monsters. Because, in point of fact, the ISIS militants, according to reports, had besieged the Yazidi people, and several individuals, according to UNICEF, as of Tuesday, 40 children who were besieged on the mountain had already died as a result of dehydration. See, sometimes, when an aggressor is obviously killing children who have no way to get away from the aggression, sometimes the United States will actually step in to stop the slaughter of the children. In this case, it was the Yazidi minority who were being slaughtered by the Sunni Muslim majority in that area, the Islamic State or ISIS fighters. Yeah. Now, meanwhile, I just got this tweet in from Isaac. The Pentagon is denying a New York Times report saying U.S. forces have begun to bomb ISIS or ISIL, Islamic State in the Levant, targets in Iraq. That's interesting. Still, I haven't seen anything to say that the New York Times is backing off what it says. Kurdish officials said the bombings targeted fighters from the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria who had seized two towns, Guer and Mahmur. Residents who had fled those areas by car were heard honking their horns in approval. There it is. Rear Admiral John Kirby, the Pentagon press secretary, said on Twitter that the reports of a U.S. strike were false. Obama administration officials had said earlier in the day, this is still from Elisa Rubin's report in the New York Times, that Mr. Obama was considering airstrikes or airdrops of food and medicine to address a humanitarian crisis among as many as 40,000 members of religious minorities in Iraq who have been dying of heat and thirst on a mountaintop where they took shelter after death threats from ISIS. Now, why would death threats be issued by ISIS against this minority population? Well, they are not an ethnic minority. They are a religious minority. Via Charlie Pierce, I learned that the Yazidi are a distant offshoot, if you will, of Zoroastrianism. Zoroastrianism, of course, was the religion as practiced by the ancient Persian Empire during the times of, say, Darius and Xerxes and Artaxerxes, Arta being a Zoroastrian manifestation or avatar of the divine. And the reason the Yazidi come in for such treatment, and have for a very long time, is because Muslims, particularly fundamentalist types, in this case Sunnis, consider them to be death-worthy because they consider their religion to be devil worship. The Yazidi apparently don't worship the Bronze Age mono-god of the so-called peoples of the book. So, these particular murderous freaks think that they get think that their god has told them that it's okay to slaughter them. Men, women, children, makes no difference. Going to Charlie Pierce's blog post, Epic Religious Wars of History, he cites an article that describes the deity as worshipped by the Yazidi. The deity is Tossi Melek, translated as the peacock angel or the peacock king. And he is apparently a world deity or avatar. And he is deemed to be the first among gods. And consequently, but is not the creator god. He's a sort of intermediary. The creator god is higher than that and above the foolishness of humankind. But oh dear, religion. See what I mean? See what I mean? So the people who believe in the one god want to kill the people who believe in the different god, neither of which can ever be empirically proven or shown to even exist. But religion is also often a common dodge for murderous impulses. So we are either we are or we are not engaged in a little taste of warfare. And a humanitarian effort to save besieged children who are trapped in a place from which they cannot escape attack. See how that works? Sometimes the United States objects to the killing of children who are trapped in a place from which they are not able to escape. Sometimes the United States does not. Sometimes the United States contemplates doing something about slaughtered children. Sometimes the United States does not. As Mr. Pierce notes, the Yazidi have been subjects of periodic attempts at genocide for about the last 700 years, and have thus far managed to hang on, albeit tenuously. So, we get to, what's the word here, wait and see. Yeah, wait and see. What else on this thorn in the side Thursday, now that we've gotten past that particular thorn? Oh, we could call this the Ebola thorn in the side Thursday. Oh, dear God, here we go. So you know that we haven't mentioned a certain individual who is pretty much grandfathered out of discussion here, to wit, Anthrax Coulter. But when she gets ignored, she starts trying to do things that will become so outrageous that somebody will please start talking about her again, please. Yeah. Well, yesterday, Anthrax Coulter declared that Dr. Kent Brantley, who has been brought back to the United States for treatment of Ebola, she said that he was engaging in Christian narcissism by going afield to do those things which Yeshua commanded his followers to do. Take care of the sick, house the homeless, clothe the naked, visit the imprisoned, that kind of thing. For if you've done it unto the least of these, my brothers, you've done it unto me. Got it? Sure. Those of us who don't buy into Christian religious dogma have a little easier time understanding that basically, see, that's not a religious tenet. That's a human tenet. That's Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and semi-literate itinerant rabbi, talking about being a basically decent human being, not talking about being a religious creature. But Anthrax Coulter doesn't like it. And she says that, echoing Donald Trump, of course, and that thing on his head, Anthrax Coulter says that Dr. Brandt should have been left wherever the F he was and gotten treatment there and not put the whole nation at risk by coming to America with his Ebola. Dr. Brandt is being treated at Emory University in Atlanta. People treating him are wearing moon suits, and all kinds of precautions are being taken to make sure the disease doesn't get outside his isolation unit. Now, he was sent over there at the behest of Samaritan's Purse, which is the dodgy operation that Franklin Graham runs, so I found myself in the odd position of being at least a little bit on the same side, but not really, as Anthrax Coulter. I don't think that Samaritan's Purse ever does anything that is truly altruistic, because they're a religion hustle. But so, Anthrax Coulter is upset about Dr. Brandt being brought back to the United States. And, okay, so go away. But, and if you go back in the archives on the Horn's website, you will find that we were posting stories months ago about the Ebola problem, while a lot of other people were focused on, the same silly shit that we focus on any given day, and for which I am sometimes myself guilty. But man, oh man, this one takes the cake. Now, Anthrax Coulter is worried about Ebola coming to America and turning into some pandemic. Right? Well, that is not what Pastor Rick Wiles is worried about. Who knew? No. Pastor Rick Wiles, a minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the common savior of humanity. Rick Wiles thinks that Ebola could actually be not a flaw, but a feature, a net good, if you will. Do tell us about it, Pastor Wiles, would you, please?
You know, this Ebola epidemic could become a global pandemic, and that's another name for plague. It may be the great attitude adjustment that I believe is coming. Ebola could solve America's problems with atheism, homosexuality, sexual promiscuity, pornography, and abortion. If Ebola becomes a global plague, you better make sure the blood of Jesus is upon you.
I love that particular analogy. You know why? Because the only way you can spread Ebola, you can't, it's not like the flu, you know, where somebody goes, wait, and a couple of days later you're going, God, I kind of ache all over and I feel kind of hot and weak and, oh, hell, not the flu. No. You've got to have direct tissue contact to blood or feces or urine or saliva or some other bodily fluid in order to get the Ebola. So Pastor Rick wants to make sure we are all bathed in blood so as to be ready for the coming Ebola epidemic. Did you notice how the Christian wants Ebola to come here? Did you hear the sort of joyful lilt in his voice as he mentioned plague? Another word for plague? Pandemic is another word for plague. And how he thinks that a mass global pandemic is little more than an attitude adjustment. You know what? If, as he implies, his bloodthirsty God is the one who sends these things upon humanity, who wants anything to do with that bloodthirsty mono-deity? I'm thinking the Peacock King has a lot more to recommend him. Hell, Witzlow Pochtli wasn't as bloodthirsty as that. Nor Xipe Totec. No. Nor Zeus. Nor Athena. Nor Poseidon. Not by a long shot. But remember, God, this guy's God, is a God of love.
You better make sure with atheism.
Oh, yeah, and that part. That's why he wants the pandemic to come. You know, come Lord Plague. Is he thinks that the plague will only strike atheists and homosexuals. Right? Yeah. Because his God will only knock down people who he doesn't like. Right? Yeah, it never. Never seems to stop. Does it?
We are the killers. We breed wars.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. Well, not we, they.
And on the third day, God created the Remington bolt-action rifle so that man could fight the dinosaurs and the homosexuals.
Amen.
Only now, Pastor Rick Wiles, follower of the Prince of Peace, says that it's not going to be the Remington bolt-action rifle. It's going to be the plague that the all-loving God sends upon the atheists and the homosexuals in order to convince them how much he loves them. Do I have that right?
Could solve America's problems with atheism, homosexuality, sexual promiscuity, pornography, and abortion. If Ebola becomes a global plague, you better make sure the blood of Jesus is upon you.
Don't you love how he revels in the idea of abortion being wiped out by Ebola? But doesn't that mean some fetuses are going to be wiped out? What? Mama's going to die of Ebola, but the fetus is going to emerge Jesus-like and triumphant from the womb? God, I despise these people.
You better make sure you've been marked by the angels so that you're protected by God. If not, you may be a candidate to meet the Grim Reaper. You know, this Ebola epidemic could become a global pandemic, and that's a...
Oh, shut up. Go and change your armor. Yeah, Jim's right. Just got a note from Jim. You know, I remember the same being said of AIDS back in the 80s. Oh, you mean back when Ronald Reagan was ignoring it? Yeah, I do too. I remember when Jerry Falwell, who, by the way, believed that Jesus Christ was born of a virgin named Mary, and that he preached for a time, and that then he was crucified, and that in being crucified he died for our sins, and rose from the dead on the third day, and then ascended to be at the right hand of God, and therefore qualifies to sit in heaven with all the other elect. Yeah, that Jerry Falwell. Yeah, Jerry Falwell said that, I think it's a direct quote, that AIDS was a quote-unquote gay plague. Isn't it funny how these followers of the Prince of Peace seem to get happiest when they're thinking about other people being slaughtered by their God? Do we begin to realize that there's probably not enough dogmatic and philosophical space between, say, the folks who are besieging the Yazidi in Kurdish Iraq? There's not enough philosophical space between them and the Rick Wileses and these other Christians to even slide a playing card. Yeah. I mean, you work past the Jesus is God thing, because that's deeply offensive to both Muslims and Jews. And when you get right down to the fundies, they're all, you know, they're just hair splitting. But they do their hair splitting with freaking swords, and usually it's our hairs they split. Yeah, Marty, I understand your sentiment. If only the Romans hadn't run out of lions. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Irish Dave noting with my reference to the Peacock King. Irish Dave says, so when the Shah of Iran, king of the Aryans, mounted the peacock throne, it had religious significance? Well, it wasn't a peacock throne just because they're fond of peacocks now, was it? So many fundies. So few lions. Ebola. But then, probably the most serious thing that I have read about the Ebola outbreak in on the western in the countries of the western portion of the continent of Africa is this. And let's phrase it in the form of a question. Why is it that this doctor had to be flown from, where was he, Liberia, to the United States to receive treatment in hopes of saving his life? Why could his life not be saved in Liberia? Now, this is not to jump over on the side of the argumentative side of anthrax culture. Far to the contrary. The fact of the matter is, people are becoming infected and dying in Guinea, in Liberia. One case showed up in Lagos, Nigeria. And the infection is spreading not because, as Pastor Wiles might suggest, they ain't Christian enough. The disease is spreading because there is not the medical infrastructure available to prevent the spread. And some of that isn't medicine. Some of that is just teaching. Because one of the, if you delve back into the mists of human evolution and the rise of human cultures, some archaeologists and anthropologists argue, well, that sounds a little Fox-style booky, doesn't it? But I can't give you chapter and verse right now. I have read the argument. I was taught the argument many years ago when I was riding my dinosaur to college. That in fact, one of the first marks of humanity itself was the way our ancestors took care of our dead. Because see, if like a hog drops dead in the pen and they're hungry enough, the other hogs will eat the dead hog. And, you know, with no moral compunction. Catfish will eat their young. A common garden variety house cat, a tomcat, having gotten a litter of kittens upon a female, will, given the chance, come and kill the kittens to throw the female back into heat. Yeah. The otter, the precious little otter, will rape baby seals to death and other otters, holding their heads underwater until they drown and continuing to copulate upon them. Not trying to ruin supper here, but there's a larger point. The theory is that when we stopped doing things like that, hey, it ain't moving, get some, you know? That we began to move towards something we recognize as humanity. And so in learning to treat our dead with some sort of reverence or a modicum of dignity, and to bury them or burn them, we began figuring some basics out. And one of the problems that attends the areas that are presently burning up with Ebola in West Africa, Western Africa, are burial traditions that involve close contact between the dead and the bereaved. There are, for instance, rules in the Abrahamic religions on how one goes about disposing of a dead body and how quickly one must go about disposing of a dead body. I think in Islam you've got 24 hours and that's it. And culturally speaking, there needs to be some teaching among the peoples where the Ebola virus is spreading so as to get them to understand no matter how much you miss them, no matter how much you love them, you can't be in close contact with their bodily fluids. But also, we need to transmit the medical technology that is apparently being used to try to save the life of this doctor in Atlanta and recognize that the doctor in Atlanta was not somehow more deserving of being saved than a poor person in Guinea or Liberia. Peter Pio, David Heinemann, and Jeremy Farrar released a joint statement regarding the treatment of Ebola. These three men are among the world's most knowing when it comes to Ebola. Al Jazeera had the story. They released a letter. Al Jazeera writes, P.O. Heinemann and Farrar, all influential infectious disease professors and respectively directors of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, the Chatham House Center on Global Health Security, and the Wellcome Trust, said there are several antiviral drugs, monoclonal antibodies, and vaccines under study for possible use against Ebola. Here's a quote from their joint statement. African governments should be allowed to make informed decisions about whether or not to use these products. For example, to protect and treat healthcare workers who run especially high risks of infection. They state that the World Health Organization, and describe it as the only body with the necessary international authority to pursue such experimental treatments, quote, must take on this greater leadership role. These dire circumstances call for a more robust international response. Experimental treatments shouldn't be rolled out generally without prior safety testing, but in the face of the critical challenge in West Africa, the World Health Organization and Western medical agencies should be helping countries weigh the risks and benefits of limited deployment of the best drug and vaccine candidates to those in the greatest need while continuously monitoring safety and efficacy. Where do these potential antiviral solutions come from? Well, there's a biotech firm called MAPP, M-A-P-P, And it has a what Al Jazeera describes as a commercial partner, Leaf Biopharmaceutical. The drug in question is called ZMAP, Z, capital Z, capital M, A-P-P. And MAP claims that it only popped up as a potential treatment for Ebola last January. So, you know, they just don't have a whole lot of the drug currently available. It's really hard to produce, and it's trying to scale up production as soon as possible. Anybody more? Anybody? So there is not a ready supply of this particular antiviral. Anybody want to make the duck drop? Come on. Let me check the chat room. Why is there not a ready supply, and why has there not been more aggressive testing of this drug? Come on, I'm watching the... There we go, Texas T in first, because money. Say the secret word and win a prize. Yeah. And so apparently what little of the drug there is available to Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, but not available to hospitals in places like Guinea and Liberia. Got it? Ain't capitalism just awesome? Don't you just love it? Hey, as quick as we can make a buck on it, we'll ship it right over. Yes, Tim. Yes. Email coming in from Tim from L.A. Hey, wait, before I go to Tim's letter, Randy just came up with a great idea. Hooray! Randy says, yes, Texas T wins a fried battery backup. It's about all we got to give around here. We're 47 minutes into the program, and our $250 fundraising goal is going nowhere in a hurry. Just thought I'd mention that. But, no, under the subject line, Jesus' blood, Tim writes, Christ's blood? We have to bathe in the blood of Jesus to avoid the Ebola virus? You know what that reminds me of? Being human, when the vampires used to drink and bathe in the blood of humans in order to remain alive. Also, according to Lottie, blood in its liquid state lasts 21 days. How in the hell can we drench ourselves in the blood of Jesus that's supposedly more than 2,000 years old? Will it rain Jesus' blood? Sounds like a Slayer song, raining blood. Christianity emulates Satanism, and these morons are against Satanism. Deep apologies, says Tim to my Satanist brothers and sisters. Yeah. Ebola. Because money. I mean, I'm sorry, but, oh, a white guy has Ebola, let's hurry him back to Atlanta. Doesn't that smell a little privilegey to you? Because it does to me. Meanwhile, back in Iraq, apparently, ISIS, or ISIL, depending on what you want to call it, and according to a report from the New York Times, has captured the largest dam in Iraq. Mm-hmm. The dateline for this, all, and this article also by Alyssa Rubin and Tim Arango in this case, the dateline, Erbil. Um, ISIL or ISIS have captured the Mosul Dam. The Mosul Dam sits on the Tigris River. It is located about 30 miles northwest of Mosul. It is used for hydroelectric purposes and provides electricity to Mosul, as well as the general water supply for a big chunk of the country there. But when I read this headline, my mind, of course, went elsewhere. Whither, Bob, whither? Well, what sent me elsewhere was this line from the New York Times story. A report published in 2007 by the United States government, which has been involved with work on the dam, warned that should it fail, a 65-foot wave of water could be unleashed across areas of northern Iraq. Mm-hmm. Where have we heard that before? Oh, wait, yeah, okay, sure. No, the wall of water that'll go down through the Coal River Valley if the sludge impoundment at Brushy Fork breaks. Not if, but when. And apparently the United States government, and in particular people people who are downstream of the dam, are right worried now. The Kurdish Peshmerga beat a hasty retreat from the dam when they were overrun by ISIL. And so ISIL is in control of the dam. And issued a statement saying, "Our Islamic State forces are still fighting in all directions, and we will not step down until the project of the caliphate is established with the will of God." These will of God people are getting under my freaking skin. You got a pastor in America who wants the will of God to manifest as a plague of Ebola upon all the atheists and the lesbians and the homosexuals. Meanwhile, you've got these ISIL assholes. Wait a minute. Let me see if I can do it. Jim's been giving me elocution lessons on that word. Assholes. Yeah. Are out there thinking that the will of God is going to be to establish a caliphate. But more than anything else, the folks downstream are afraid of ISIL deciding to blow the dam up. Because, you know, these fundies do like to blow stuff up. May I commend to you, for instance, your consideration of the ancient relics at Bamiyan in Afghanistan. Giant statues of the Buddha. The compassionate Buddha that were blown into indistinguishable hunks of dust by the fundies of that area, the Taliban. Now, what's dangerous is that these kind of things can get the right-wing hawks in this country all up into an absolute, no doubt about it, straight-up lather. But what makes it even worse is that ordinarily reasonable people can decide to go along too. And say, oh yeah, this is obviously a justified use of force. Oh, for pity's sakes. And And that's why I get a little bit nervous when I see this sort of thing. 65-foot wall of water. I do not mean to be insensitive when I say, at least that's water. By the way, CNN reporting humanitarian airdrop missions have begun in Iraq. That would be for, among others, the Yazidi people who are under siege. Maybe that was what the Kurdish folks who were talking in Iraq mistakenly, but I guess they hoped were actual bombs. Or maybe we're bombing. Or maybe we're hellfire missiling. You know, a little drone here, a little drone there. Or maybe it ain't the United States. Maybe we got somebody else to do the business for us. I don't know. We'll just kind of have to wait and see, I suppose. But it's a hell of a spot to be in. And I would submit to you that deciding to get our war back on in Iraq is not going to make anything any better. I don't think. So that's the filibobster for the beginning of this Thorn in the Side Thursday. I have other thorns. Lots and lots of thorns. And maybe you've got some you'd like to bring to the table, too. If so, if that is the case, you are more than welcome so to do. The phone number is 304-574-8178. Thank you, Isaac. Isaac via Twitter. The Pentagon is in full-on denial mode. The Pentagon says there have been no humanitarian drops in Iraq, despite reports from CNN correspondent Jim Sciuto. Okay. I guess we'll have to find out. If there aren't any Yazidis in a couple of days, we'll know that the Pentagon wasn't lying. So let's take a break. You can chime in on the discussion if you so choose. You are welcome to, as noted. If you want to just reach out Skype to Skype, it's Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. That works too. Or you can always jump in via email, via Twitter, as Isaac has. You can reach out on Facebook, Bob Kincaid, at Bob Kincaid on Twitter, and plain old BobKincaid@gmail.com. It all works just dandy. This is listener-supported conversation radio, though at the moment you couldn't tell it to look. Sorry. I'm Bob Kincaid. We'll be right back. couldn't pass on the classic from Led Zeppelin, When the Levee Breaks. Nope, just couldn't. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. Thorn in the Side Thursday for this 7th day of August 2014. Thanks going out to Asa for getting us started this evening. We are now only $230 away from the fundraising goal, and it is much, much, much appreciated. Thank you, Asa. Just a little bit of a follow-up on that regarding the Mosul Dam. You might find this interesting. Yeah, I mentioned the assessment that was done by U.S. officials in conjunction with the war of choice that we waged on the people of Iraq. Think Progress notes, what observers now fear is that ISIS will open the floodgates, sending a tidal wave out against the populace of Mosul. The dam already didn't have the best track record when it comes to safety. What the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, Sigir, said was, in terms of internal erosion potential of the foundation, Mosul Dam is the most dangerous dam in the world. If a small problem at Mosul Dam occurs, failure is likely. Later that year, USACE said that dam failure at Mosul was exceptionally high. Remember, they called it the most dangerous dam in the world. They estimate that should a catastrophic event occur, the people of Mosul would be hit by that wall of water in 3 to 4 hours. And Mosul is no small town. Not to get all single issue-y or anything, but can I point out that the children at the Head Start, at the mouth of the holler where the Brushy Fork Dam sits, will be killed almost instantaneously when the Brushy Fork Dam goes in West Virginia. May I point out that the state police detachment will go with them. Mm-hmm. And that won't be no 3 or 4 hours. That will be almost instantaneously. Gee, I wonder if the Mosul Dam, I wonder if the Tigris River Lake behind that dam is sitting on a bunch of hollowed out, already full of water, old coal, underground coal works. You think? I don't. I wonder if the Mosul Dam is larger than the Hoover Dam. I don't think so. I'm just saying that most dangerous dam in the world is a rather fluid term, to say the very least. Then Ambassador to Iraq Ryan Crocker, remember he was one of Bush's cronies, and General David Petraeus, and we remember him, they wrote a letter together to our Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki in 2007. In that letter, they said, quote, a catastrophic failure of Mosul Dam would result in flooding along the Tigris River all the way to Baghdad. Assuming a worst-case scenario, an instantaneous failure of Mosul Dam filled to its maximum operating level could result in a flood wave 65 feet deep at the city of Mosul, which would result in a significant loss of life and property. They predicted that a 15-foot high wave would strike Baghdad 280 miles away. The U.S. government actually thought it worth the time and money of the taxpayers to study that dam. They have to date not thought it worthwhile to study the leaky. This is just a perspective thing. I'm not saying anybody's got it worse than anybody else. We don't have the ISIL fighters here in Appalachia. We've just got coal companies. But the U.S. government thought it was worth your tax dollars to study that dam. They have never studied the Brushy Fork impoundment, relying instead on the goodwill of the coal industry to inspect itself. Oh, by the way, the coal industry has been permitted by the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection to blast next to the Brushy Fork impoundment. Yes, really, blast. Ammonium nitrate and fuel oil explosives. Goodly number of them. With the argument being made by the DEP, well, it's going to make the dam better. I don't think even the U.S. Army would think that setting off blasts by the Mosul Dam would make the Mosul Dam stronger. But the West Virginia DEP guy, on camera no less, said, I looked it up on the Google. You know, because the Internet never lies. Just say it. Just say it. By the way, been talking rather a lot lately about climate change denial, and got a very interesting missive in this morning from our buddy Scott in Sweden, where they happen to be dealing with climate change, just like the rest of the planet, except for the people who think they're not because Jesus, or because money, or because stupid. Hey, Bob or Rebob. Climate change proceeds despite wingnut denial. Wait a second, I'm wrong. It proceeds because of wingnut denial. A summary of Sweden's experience in 2014. This spring, we had over a week of unseasonably warm weather that lured cherry and blueberry into blossoming. Normally, plants do not respond to a few freak days of unusual weather, but have evolved instead to respond to periods of weather. Naturally, the out-of-season heat this spring was followed by a reversion to form the following week, and the cold killed the budding flowers and the stem growth buds. The cherry trees and blueberries bushes leafed, but there are very few cherries to be found where I live, and blueberries only on steep northern slopes. Thus, because of that week of good, i.e. warm weather, we lose two crops. 2 years ago, it was the late unseasonable 100-year summer rain that caused all the wheat, rye, oat, and rapeseed to rot in the fields. This July passed, arguably due to the lack of snow cover in Siberia, allowing the sun to heat the far north uncharacteristically early, and I'll add editorially, create some damned interesting big holes in the ground. There has been a high-pressure system just sitting over European Russia. Sweden is on the western edge of that high-pressure cell. Until just this week, as the cell slowly weakens, rain has been going both north and south of us. So Sweden has been unseasonably warm all of July. Climate-related events have a way of cascading. Without the usual abundance of berries, cherries, and little pools of water in forest hidey holes, wasps and birds have been seeking out the few that are left, so they're finishing off whatever such fruit managed to form. Although the apples, which generally blossom a week after the cherries and blueberries, managed to take a pass on the early heat spell and are looking pretty good, insects and birds, in not finding enough juicier fruit, are now turning to apples, so we'll just have to wait and see how much they take. And no, there will not be any spraying of critter kill on the fruit trees. Well, good. Last weekend, a forest fire broke out that has now become the largest ever seen in Sweden. Like any good forest fire, dry fir trees on dry soil makes it very hard to control. As Sweden has never had fires like this before, we had to ask France and Italy for their water bombing planes, which have just now arrived. The news media, M-E-D-J-A, the news media, always in love with the tough question, has been asking the authorities why our preparedness was so poor. Why don't we have fixed-wing water bombers? Why do we only have helicopters with small one-ton loads? And here's where the story differs from what the U.S. media would report. The authorities are reporting that it is climate change that has changed the game, and it has now become time to prepare in a way that had never been necessary before. The media replies, well, we all know that climate change has been going on a while. Why did you wait to invest? And off they go, arguing over when these decisions should have been taken instead. Here's the good news. Central to all sides' position is the notion of climate change being real and forcing change on our own society. Not every ostrich sticks its head in its hands and plays three monkeys. Speak no climate change, see no climate change, hear no climate change. All I can say here is that the state-financed media, absent big business, ad buys, is still a blessing. Thank pasta that the conservatives here have not yet privatized that. More good news. Being a recently, Pleistocene, glaciated landscape, The region where the fire is has some large lakes that eventually constricted the fire into a confinable area, and it seems the danger is over. In a lakeless landscape, this could and would have gotten very, very ugly very fast. Remember how Russia burned a few summers ago? Uncertain news. Now that the Russian high-pressure system is weakening as the polar days grow shorter again, we may finally get some of the copious rain that has been diverted north and south of us. And since only a fraction of the grain has been harvested, we'll see if we get a repeat of the rot of a few years ago. I'll save you the story of 5 years ago of another cascade of events in the mountains stemming from another unseasonably springtime warm spell, except that to say too many of these are 100-year events to be real 100-year events. They look like they are becoming the new reality. Now I'm off to swim in unseasonably warm Lake Mälaren, which hasn't been this warm since they began records well over a century ago. Ta-ta for now, our buddy Scott. How about that? What would it be like to live in a country where when a problem arises, everybody says, yeah, definitely a problem, definitely real, and we're going to squabble over what should have been done when? Hell, this is America. We can't even get to the squabbling part over whether anything should be done. Because money. Wolverines! Freedom! Yeah. Hey, let's go to the phones. Welcome to the program. Hello?
Hello?
Oh, hey, Edward.
Yeah. We're listening to all this stuff about religion. I thought of something that Christopher Morrow said.
Oh, yes.
He said, religion is but a childish toy. The only sin is ignorance.
And interestingly enough, he got dead real quick, didn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying, I'm just saying.
Yeah, I know. But I also remember something I'd written down that Juanita in Florida said one time. He said, some of the best Christians are atheists. And I agree.
Well, atheists actually tend to have a better handle on the good side of the teachings of various religious avatars than their followers do. I mean, that's been proven by study.
Absolutely.
I can't remember the think tank that did it a few years ago, but there was a poll asking members of various religious faiths to talk about various religious beliefs, and without fail, the atheists knew more about everybody's religion, which kind of explained why they were atheists.
True words were never spoken.
You know, sometimes they bring you in, they teach you the lodge handshake, the high sign, all of that stuff, you know, brother coming from the west, brother going to the east, all for the sake of the widow's son, all of that stuff, and you go, wow, this is a load of crap.
Yeah, well, you know, all of these fundamentalists say that Jesus is God, but if I remember something out of the Bible, which I read a long time ago, I don't remember a whole lot about it, but he admonished his disciples for calling him God, and he said he wasn't God.
Who did
now,
people...
I don't know where it is in the New Testament, but it's in there somewhere.
Well, there's
lots of stuff in there.
Yeah, there's that whole who do people say I am? Some people say you are the return of the prophet Elisha, blah, 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 blah.
Rock. Mm-hmm.
And then Peter says something, and he says, upon this rock I shall build my church.
Yeah.
I personally think he was making sport of Peter, because Peter's not the brightest bulb in the socket.
The word Petra is the word for rock.
Right.
So... whatever.
Well, I mean, okay, let's remember, it's probably likely that Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant semi-literate rabbi, had at least, because he grew up around a place called Sephora, which was a Hellenized, you know, a Greek town, so he probably knew some gutter Greek, you know, kind of like the Greek of the New Testament. It's gutter Greek. It's not It's not the classic Greek of Homer or the Greek that, say, Roman nobles learned. This was the patois of the ghetto, if you will. And for instance, because also around there were various statues of a dude named Alexander, and written on the plinth under the statue were the words, Common Savior of Humanity. Well, everybody knew the Alexander stories.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And everybody knew who Alexander's horse was, Edward. And Alexander's horse was named Boikephalos, if my Greek pronunciation is anywhere near correct.
You're better than me.
And Boikephalos means rockhead. So rockhead was probably in play. And for all we know, what Yeshua actually called Peter was rockhead.
Well, that was a good thing to call him.
Yeah, I'm going to build my church on you, rockhead. I'm telling you, there's all kinds of one-liners in the Gospels.
Oh, I know. Oh, me. But, you know, I get real tired of some of these people. I really do.
Imagine sitting there basically mentally masturbating over your yearning for plague to come to the United States. I mean,
and washed in the blood, that just really gets me.
Oh, I know.
I don't want to be washed in the blood.
No, you know, and by the way, since we're talking about the classical world, you know where they Bogarted that from, right, Edward?
Well, I used to, but I'm old.
There was a cult that was particularly popular among the legions, in which, in order to become an initiate, you would pray or chant or huff incense or some combination of those things, and then when you were all done, you would stand all naked down
in
the pit.
Now I remember. Yes,
and they would slaughter a bull over you, and you mm-hmm. would be literally washed in the blood.
Yeah, now I remember. Thank you for bringing back that memory.
Yeah, there went dinner for a whole lot of the Horn Family Commune congregation.
Oh, well, they'll get over it, darling. Oh, damn, I called you darling again. I got to quit doing that.
Oh, no. I kind of like it myself, but so you feel free.
Well, see, down where I'm from, we call everybody darling and honey.
Yeah, well, yeah, honey, absolutely.
Well, you all take care, and I just thought that quote from Christopher Marlowe just sort of hit it on the nail's head for me, because they don't know they're sinning, but if anybody's sinning, the Christians are.
Oh, they've got it down to a science.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, as they say, this too shall pass, but I won't be around to see it, unfortunately. But I hope it will pass someday. It's been going on since about, what, 1830? With all these fundamentalists?
Oh, well, are you talking about the end times eschatological? Yeah, that's about when, yeah. And it's a goober in England by the name of Darby, I do believe.
That's right, absolutely. He started the whole damn thing.
And the next thing you know, a couple of jackasses, one of whom's name is LaHaye, are making a small fortune writing the Left Behind series.
Oh dear, what a mess!
The only thing that should have been left behind were all those books on the shelves.
Well, I tell you one thing: rather than be with them, I'd rather be left behind.
I don't want to go to any heaven that's got Jerry Falwell in it.
Oh no, or Huxtable either.
No.
Oh, I was going to tell you, you know, let them starve.
Yeah, Pastor Hagee.
Old Huxley's face down there in San Antonio. I used to have a frog that lived under my front porch. And every evening when I turned the light on, this great big frog would come out and sit there on the porch and eat bugs that flew to the light. And I named him after that preacher in San Antonio. Of course, he looked just like him. He was a big, fat thing, and he had a great big mouth. And he looked just like that preacher. And, of course, finally, I think the frog died. And he definitely didn't starve to death. So maybe that's what's wrong with that preacher down there in San Antonio. He's been eating too much fried chicken and potatoes and gravy. He can't even get out of his chair anymore, I hear.
No, he's doing everything seated at a desk in the middle of the stage now.
Oh, my word.
It's like some sort of really perverse pinter play or something.
Oh, please. Well, then there were Jerry Falwell, and goodness sakes, just him walking across the room was a jiggle show. Everything jiggled.
Now, doggone it, Edward, you're only allowed one revolting visual per call, okay? You just moved over into two.
I'm sorry.
Whatever shall we do?
Well, there are the things that nightmares are made of.
Hear, hear, and amen.
Take care and have a good evening, and I'm sorry I ruined your dinner.
I'll try to get it back one way or another. If nothing else, a good sugar crash will fix it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I'll gnaw shoe leather when one of those comes on. Edward, you have a good evening.
You have a good evening. Wonderful talking to you again.
It's always a joy, Edward. Take care.
Bye bye.
Our good friend Edward, calling from Dallas. I gotta say, I love the idea of John Hagee being, you know, Pastor Frogface. Eating bugs. Another bug pastor? See, that's how it would play in hell. You know, he's turning on the barbecue spit. You're looking a little peaked there, Pastor. Would you like another bug? Yeah. Let's go back to the phone. Say, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
What's happening, Bill?
Well, I was just listening. Who referenced the peacock throne? Who was that?
The peacock throne was what was sat upon.
Yeah, I know what it was. But I mean, who are the family members? Who caught that? Dave.
Not sure what you're...
Well, the fellow emailed or something, emailed in reference to the peacock throne.
Oh, Irish Dave. Yeah, Irish Dave, yeah.
Irish Dave. Yeah, that's, I remember Hammett making in one of his short stories that was called This King Business. There was some sound in some town in the Balkans somewhere, and a guy was carrying around a picture of a Russian soldier who became the Tsar. I mean, became the Shah of Iran. And Hammett referenced the peacock throne, and I said, I'll be darned. I haven't heard that used in a long time. But you made some references to, I didn't know what was their big deal in, well, Mesopotamia, they could grow wheat, right?
Well, yeah.
That whole area could grow food.
Yeah, and
they didn't have any other stuff.
Right, after the rise of agriculture, basic agriculture, then you get the rise of irrigation.
You hit it on the head with these. There's a place, I don't know whether it's in PA or Ohio or on the border, where there's coal mines burning underground and have been burning for years.
Yeah, that's in Pennsylvania, right.
Mm-hmm. And in Lake Erie, there's a ship, the Cleve Coal, that has been leaking oil since the 40s, drop at a time. Like it's off of what we would call Euclid Beach area, the east side of Cleveland.
Oh, and Jim, Jim wants you to know that the soldier you're referring to is Sergeant Reza Pahlavi.
Ah,
that's your Shah.
Yeah, yep, that was the. And I said I had a slight connection with that with one of my. The bar I played primarily, the owner's of the place's wife, her brother was a hostage over there. And I don't think he was doing anything any more wrong than any of the other diplomatic team members, you know. Because that goes a lot deeper than showing up with a nice shirt and tie for a dinner, you know. That kind of stuff. There's more depth to it than that as far as learning a little of this and a little of that, and and take it with you when you go, and then tell somebody else about it. Because I have my doubts. Are you familiar with the Zimmerman note?
Yeah.
You think that was for real?
You mean the Zimmerman telegram?
Yeah. Was it for real and they just played it up real bad?
As far as I know, it was real. It was an attempt by the German government in, what, toward the end of the First World War to try to get Mexico to invade the United States. And wasn't Mexico's response, what, are you crazy?
Yeah. Well, there were some actions down around, I think it was far away, it was the 1870s. There was a U.S. incursion into off the same route that that Winfield Scott took, same city, and there was they made a movie about it, and it was about 1880 or something. I guess like the French, the French had loaned the Mexicans so damn much money, and they were not collected by putting one of Napoleon III's relatives on the the throne of Mexico.
Yeah, wasn't that Maximilian?
Yep. And they decided not to hang around. I know Stanton went to Secretary of War, sent Sheridan and 50,000 men to the Texas border, not just to make sure you shoot out any of the Confederate holdovers, but you demonstrated to the French that, it wasn't wise to hang around. Plus, the Mexican freedom fighters were kicking their butts anyway. I know the Foreign Legion had a place called Camarón. It was like a ranch. And they fought it hard, and that's the national day for the Foreign Legion. That's the day they celebrate the existence of the unit, you know. How come we haven't started one of those, Bob?
I guess we're just not wasn't the French Foreign Legion made up of colonials?
Yeah, it was made up of anybody that needed a job.
I think of for instance the UK and the British Empire's Gurkhas.
Yes. Yeah. Well, boy, those guys. You just mentioned some hard fighting East Indians, man. From the east, from the subcontinent, at least. I wouldn't call them Indians, because they were hard cases, the Gurkhas. And another bunch were the Philippine Scouts. The guys we trained after the 1898, they made a hell of a name for themselves in the early days of World War II. They hurt the Japanese badly. Yeah, get these guys who don't have anything and make soldiers out of them. And in fact, the guy that wrote Hell in a Very Small Place, his line, I think, was that the Foreign Legion of D&D and Fu spoke with a German accent.
I had no idea.
Yeah, oh, there was tons of them. It's the old story. They didn't know what to do. And a friend of mine's father was riding a truck. He'd been kicked out of the POW camp at the place where St. Pauli girl comes from, you know? The city was Hamburg? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, which...
Trying to find his way home, you know.
Right.
And the Russians almost took him off of a truck. And, of course, once the Russians did that, you were liable to never be seen again. Because the Germans made a very bad bed for themselves in Russia. And the price was to be paid, you know, the old story. In fact, you ever read the works of Bill Malden?
No, I can't say as I have.
Cartoonist. Still can't find it. World War II, William Joe, two dog-faced.
Oh, but yeah, babies. Sure, okay, yeah, I didn't recognize my name, but yeah, William Joe?
Two Germans are standing there, one's got a pile of money, and the other's counting off a list of how much they got for the Luger, how much for the camera, how much for this. At the end of the last line, it's good to be captured by the Americans. Because there's plenty about the American way, Bob. Buy something and, heck, I had a bunch of reflexes. I had a bunch of Kodak Bellows cameras. And my second wife took off with them. They're all worth a few bucks, so she took them when she left. So, you know, that's how people operate in the business, you know. The divorce business can become a real problem. But, the Peacock phone and the... I'll tell you whose father was active in Iran during World War II. At the end of it, he had been a Howard Patrol officer, and he was in on the Lindbergh thing. He was involved in that case. And his son beat the Iraqis to death in the first Iraq War.
Schwarzkopf.
Schwarzkopf.
Yeah, Blackhead.
Yep. And it's so funny, the story about Fitz Lee. You know who Fitz Lee was, Fitz Hugh Lee?
Yeah.
During the Spanish-American War, the Spaniards were retreating. He stood up, thinking, he started yelling about, look at those Yankees run. You can't clear your soul, you know.
You can't, break them, no.
No.
Oh, by the way, Irish Dave did, with regard to what you were saying about the Foreign Legion, Irish Dave pointed out that the French Foreign Legion at Dien Bien Phu had so many ex-members of the Wehrmacht that the orders were quite often given in German.
That's why there was... it was funny, the Legion had had guys for so long. There was a half a dozen or a dozen guys who were Spanish in origin. And they had joined the Foreign Legion after they couldn't beat Franco. Right?
Right.
So here they are in a country fighting a fascist war themselves against somebody else. And they did fought hard against, well, what was it, you were a Saturday Night Live guy? I wasn't, because I had to work.
Oh, no, it depends. Some, yeah, some not. I remember a good bit of the early days, because I was young and in school and had reached that age where I liked to stay up late just to show how, you know, grown up I was.
Good bunch.
Oh,
fun bunch.
Brilliant.
Yes. The cheeseburgers and, you go to Cincinnati much?
I haven't spent a lot of time there, no. I was just raised to be a Reds fan, that's all.
Yeah, your dad was a Reds fan, yeah. That was a classic picture of the Reds taken during the flooding. Of the guys rolling around the base pass. People don't even know about those floods. There was a massive amount of floods right before the Depression. And, in fact, that's where the deal came when they blew the dams below New Orleans and the Cajuns were flooded out, literally, to save the city of New Orleans. Bob, you ever look at that city and you wonder, well, how the hell did they build a city there?
The only part of the city that's above sea level is the Vieux Carré, is it not?
Yep. Basically, yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's why there's a good book on the big storm, you know, how can I forget the name of that one? It happened in our lifetimes recently.
What, Katrina?
Yeah. That was a whole bit of the problem, because that area where a lot of people were living was really not a good area to live.
No, Lower Ninth Ward was pretty poverty-stricken. I mean, people like Kate are far better... are suited to talk about it than I. But remember, they just had, it had to be depopulated. I tell you what, you've absolutely brought out the worst in Irish Dave this evening. He says, come on, Bob, 10 minutes. Come on, Bob, 10 minutes in Cincinnati's a long time.
I played a place down there called the Black Dome, and I still have the poster for it. And in fact, we were before Mayall and after somebody else, or after Mayall and before some other rocker. The times were right, Bob. I was getting a lot of breaks to play and playing places like that. But what I like, and you can order it, you can buy it in a package. so-called Cincinnati chili.
Oh, yeah, I know about that stuff. Yeah.
And that's...
Doesn't speak to me even a little bit.
What?
I don't like cinnamon in my spaghetti sauce. It ain't chili.
My daughter was adopted out because I was messing with a... Bob, when you're a guy like me, you don't mess around with rich man's daughters, you know?
Yeah, probably.
They ain't going to marry you. They don't do anything else but except that, you know? And she tasted it one time, and she said, Dad, this tastes like Crepe spaghetti sauce. Because you're right, it's the cinnamon, and there's something else in there besides cinnamon, too, that's what makes a real chili dog, to me, is that flavor. Because most of the places up here that serve it are Greek-owned. There was a place called the Victory Lunch, in it's now one of the seediest neighborhoods of the city, but they made those, I'll tell you, all kind of stuff was being built there in the 40s, including the trucks, the cab overs. Man, my memory's dying, you know. I mean, I don't have half of what I used to have, but bothers the hell out of me. The cab over truck, damn it, I know the name of the damn thing pretty much.
Peterbilt?
What?
Peterbilt?
No, they were bought by a foreign outfit. Come on, somebody jump on it and bail the old man out on that one, would you? But that was them. What happened, you tilted the cab to work on it. And they were making them around 81st and St. Clair in the city of Cleveland. They were building them like there was no...
Not Mac.
No tomorrow. If they didn't build anywhere...
It's not Peterbilt, Mac, Kenworth?
No. They were purchased by a foreign company. It begins with a C. I can't tell you. Somebody's trying to get me, not that I give it to him. It's somewhere in the damn computer, and I'll find it in a second. Won't bore you to death. I'll let you go after this one. But it was a real popular truck and made here in Cleveland, like so many things. Well, holy God. White motors. It was a white.
I'm licked.
Freightliner? Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Four years ago, it was just plain old white motors. And my uncle had a job that you and Jim would have liked, my mother's brother. He worked for a company, I think I've told you this too many times before, Film Transit Company. They were all things of film from the first run to the neighborhood piers. That's how they handled it in those days. Now you... Do it right through your television set, can't you? Anyway, I'll let you go. But now, man, yeah, when you hit the nail on the head it was all, you know, again, it's all about the oil.
Always is.
That whole area is all about the oil. And my
wait, just a minute, Bill. I think we have to revise that. At this point in time, the whole planet is about the hydrocarbons, okay? The whole planet. We can't talk about regions or areas because nobody is safe now. Alberta, big chunks of the Canadian province of Alberta have been turned into a toxic wasteland. The fracking areas of PA are an environmental nightmare. Same thing with West Virginia.
A woman I know who lives down by the arsenal and near Youngstown, they approached her about buying the rights to frack her land. They gave her half the money and then they reneged on the rest of it. This is how they do business, Bob.
Sure.
They must have gone in there and couldn't find anything, so the hell with it. We won't pay the balance.
Well, look, there's a guy who is revered as a philanthropist, billionaire in West Virginia. His name's Jim Justice. He bought the Greenbrier Resort, which I'm sure you know what that is.
Yeah.
And he puts on a golf tournament and concerts around the 4th of July. and he's giving money to this and giving money to that. And it turns out the guy's a deadbeat. He's a coal baron, and he's got a stack of violations taller than he is in Kentucky and Virginia and Tennessee and West Virginia. And somebody tried to ask him about it, and he said, well, we didn't have any choice. We had to leave those. The guy has left the mountaintop removal projects unreclaimed when the law itself says that when you're doing it, you have to reclaim continuously as you mine.
And
he's just walked away from it, and he's filthy rich, and he's stiffing four different states.
Well, they turned a lot of those things around I-71 and such into fishing areas and camping areas. Those, you know, when it blew out and they put water in it and fish in it, and somehow they have to keep the fish going and keep this alive. And in other words, don't look at my left hand. Watch my left hand instead. We'll fix it right up for you. Sure you will. And, you know, it's, I feel for you guys because what you had was a product that when push comes to shove, what do? To heat your home in the 1870s or 1880s or a cook? Wood stove, yeah.
Yeah.
And the only thing about the wood is you can grow more, you know?
Well, absolutely. That's why I keep saying time after time that Appalachia was sustainable before sustainable was cool.
Yeah.
You could homestead a patch of ground, had a bunch of trees on it, and you couldn't deforest it for heat and cooking wood fuel if you tried. It's only with the arrival of the railroads and their massive need for cross ties and timbers for bridge building, and then and that's followed by the coal industry, and by the year 1900, most of West Virginia is treeless.
I've only been through it a few times on my way. We used to go down, come out in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and buy some nice rust-free cars. And, you know, drag them back, or drive one back and drag another one back, and you could pick up a few bucks doing that. The old American hustle, Bob.
Sure.
Because, I loved it because you give me a rust-free car, and I'll run that son of a gun for 15 years, you know, until the body rots out on it. Because as long as you can, in those days, change an engine, no problem. We'll figure it out somehow. A guy that bought my house up not far from where I am now, he stopped over to visit me because he knew me through music. And so he just stopped to talk to me because he hadn't seen me in years. And he said, yeah. I bought that damn house. I opened the garage. There's a damn Chevy small block V8 sitting on the floor of the garage. Yeah, I said, I think that was a 283. Because we put a 327 in it. Got rid of a 307 and put a 327 in it. That was your car, buddy.
Oh,
I was racing that thing up and down after gigs, and I was dating a young woman who was a young woman. And it was a nice, she had a little girl, and it was a fun relationship. She was related to an ex-girlfriend of mine. And her mother said, hey, could you even deal with her for a while? I said, nothing better. I mean, you're coming out of a 10-year marriage, and you go into a relationship with a pretty young girl, it's like, what problems, you know? And that brought me about 4 or 5 months to where I grew up again after the divorce. Yeah, I went through the mess, and I was all growing up and had a good time with this kid because she was such a nice kid and she had a beautiful little girl, and that was a pleasure to spend time with in that environment. Because, Bob, my environment's been pretty damn, you know, that the housing project. The one housing project I lived in, Eleanor Roosevelt flew in and opened it up in 1938. And there was like two or three of them close by. And people don't realize what those were or why they were built. The surrounding neighborhoods, Bob, were falling on their faces. I mean, these were places that were built in the 1880s in the heart of the city. And you know what you got in 1880 in the way of a house? the fire trap. How about that one house had gas jets in it, Bob? People were burning gas for lighting.
Oh, no, I know a little bit about that because, see, we lived in a house once upon a time, Bill, that had been built at the time of the first gas boom in West Virginia. And it just had gas flowing to it from literally straight out of the well. I mean, it was sopping wet and it would freeze in winter. And so we had to put a drying mechanism on it where it would pass through propylene glycol bubbler on the way in. But yeah, the house was plumbed for gas lighting and it had these terrifying little floor-based gas heaters in every individual room.
Yeah,
and it was just a metal frame that sat over top of gas jets that you lit with a match.
Well, after my second divorce, I moved in with a buddy of mine, and this guy didn't have enough money to keep the gas turned on. So, in fact, his furnace was defective. So, what am I burning for heat? Propane heaters, Bob. You know, the ones you stand up, the 20-pounders?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
They had a heater on them. I used them originally. They were a great thing to use when you're trying to keep your hands from falling off or you're working on a car in 10-degree weather. But it wasn't exactly what you should have in a house. Well, I bored you to tears. But you guys get going on this stuff, and it's just amazing. In fact, they just did a, did I tell you, they just did a celebration at Liège. Not a celebration, a memorial. And Liège was the first place where Ludendorff made a name for himself. He kind of talked the Belgians out of the fort. Because they all were building all these countries had these huge fortresses. And the French tried to do the same thing again in the 30s, and it didn't work, did it? Because the Germans came through the Ardennes where they weren't supposed to be able to go. You know that, don't you?
Yeah, oh yeah.
And that's why they went all the way to the ocean, and they had to Dunkirk the English army the hell out of there. In fact, Hitler tried to pull the same stuff in 1944 in the Battle of the Bulge. He was going to try to break through all the way to the sea.
Right.
Again.
Yeah.
That's nice with them. That's a real one. You know, there you know you got somebody insane. If you did it once, well, you can do it again, can't you? Nobody will notice this time either. But yeah, the British and French got caught short-handed because they had been told that armored tracked vehicles could not operate through those hills, through that forest. Well, so much for listening to experts, you understand?
Yeah.
That's why every time something happens where they talk, like, I don't know about this situation in Iraq, because the Kurds have been, you know, the Kurds have been fighting for their freedom for ages. They've been wanting their own country. I mean, Kurdistan runs all the way across through Turkey and Iraq, and possibly even some in Iran. It's a strong ethnic group, you know. I'm sure you're familiar with that, but they wanted their own.
Absolutely, yes.
And now look what's going on. I don't know. What's your opinion? Do we have to go in there and shut those guys off?
I don't mean to bust out all isolationists, but I'm anti-war, Bill.
Yeah, I don't blame you one bit.
Let's square this up real quick. We started a war with Iraq in 2003.
Yeah. Well, we had no good reason to do it either, really.
No. The entire thing was started on a tissue paper of lies for which, if there were any justice in this world, people like George Bush and Dick Cheney and Kinda Sleazy Rice and Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld and the rest of the whole filthy crew would be standing in the dock at The Hague, because any other nation that did what we did would have been called to account. Okay, one. Two, in the process of that war based upon lies and rah-rah cheerleading of lies, we got killed several thousand members of the American military service branches.
And of course,
we also killed upwards of a million, conservatively estimated, innocent Iraqi civilians. We did all of that by our own choice, Bill.
Yes.
We made a complete wreck of the place, just like George W. Bush's daddy and his advisors said would happen. You know, I don't just run around praising those guys, but they were right, and George W. Bush did it anyway, because, you know, he's got daddy issues.
Well, he went against his own military advisors, and that's crazy when you do that.
And so now we are in a position where the mess we made is getting worse. And there is no credible argument for us going back in there and screwing things up again, because there is no way that the United States can ever make any of it right. And I certainly understand the humanitarian crisis involved with this. But I don't see us as being much good at solving humanitarian crises, especially not in that region.
But what do we do with our friends that we deposited there after World War II and called it Israel? My first wife, Dean, her last name was Katz, she used to always tell me, Bill, maybe we should have went to Miami and brought these folks to Miami. She said, we owned it already anyhow. It was her facetious way of dealing with something, but...
What was the joke, the punchline was Katz and Katz's lawyer?
Yeah, that's what Four Legs and Chases Cats, Mrs. Katz and her lawyer.
Right.
In fact, somebody just got me a copy of a book that I have to have put on tape. It's called Vaudeville by a guy named Joe Laurie Jr. and somebody else. It really, because that aspect of show business, really, when you look at it and study it, it's everything you have today comes from something like that. And I don't know, I can't stand the movies anymore. I guess I'm the wrong person for them, but... you know, and these situation, so-called situation shows on television.
Reality shows, yeah. Blech.
I'll let you go with one line, and if that's reality, please hand me that big hat with the letter N on it, you know?
Yeah.
For Napoleon.
Right.
That's what you need to watch that crap. Anyway, stay out of trouble.
All right, gonna try. Bill, good talking to you.
Good night.
Bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, legendary bluesman calling from Cleveland. Always good to hear. Bill. Apparently there's something going on with one of the streams. I saw a mention in the chat room, and now I saw that from John in Canada. Now I see it from our buddy Angry, who says he's getting Norman Golden. What? Stream should be working just fine. Maybe that explains why we're still at $230 to go for our fundraising goal. Because we are. 23 folks at 10 bucks apiece would get us squared up. Otherwise, we're going to march into Friday on the front porch tomorrow in a hole. No doubt about it. Let's see. Let's take a break. Why not? Your calls are always welcome here on Thorn in the Side Thursday or any other day, really. We've got plenty of thorns to go through if you don't want to ring up the telephone device, 304-574-8178. And Skype to Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, of course. And then email bobkincaid@gmail.com. Oh, my God. Let's make Anthrax Coulter go away. Marty's saying, I've had a couple of hiccups that have dropped me from the horn to KPFA. I don't even know how that happens. Because we are in no wise affiliated or associated with KPFA. At all. Ever. Anytime. That's not a critique. No idea. No idea at all. So, a little break on the way. And then we'll come back to your calls. This is Thorn in the Side Thursday on the Horn. And, I'm Bob Kincaid. We'll be back.
I was a post-war baby and mom's got a smile. I was 3 years old, moved down south. Hard times written in my mother's books, with a widow's pension and her ration books. And I remember took the miner's court to the House of Commons in his cold dozen voice. We were locked up, safe and warm from the snow. Life with the lions on the radio. And Churchill said to ruin my father, I just can't stand to see you today. How could you have come and get an end to your away? Hands and there's no good talking or making plans. But Churchill, he just flapped his wings. Said I don't really care to discuss these things at all. Every time I look at you, I feel so low, I don't know what to do. Well, every day just seems to bring back news. Leaves me here with the post-World War II blues. 1959 was a very strange time. A bad year for labor and a good year for wine. Uncle Ike was our American pal. Nobody talked about the Suez Canal. I can still remember the last time I cried. The day that Buddy Holly died. I never met him, so it may seem strange. Don't some people just affect you that way? And all, and all that was good, there even seemed to be an optimistic mood. While TW3 sat and laughed at it all. Said I can never believe it could happen like this. But all, every time I look at you, I feel so low, I don't know what to do. Well, every day just seems to bring back news. Leaves me here with the post World War II. Jacket and a head full of dreams. In coffee bars I spend my nights reading Allen and Ginsberg talking civil rights. The day Robert Kennedy got shot down, the world was wearing a deeper frown. Though I knew that we'd lost a friend, I always believed we could win in the end. Cause music was the scenery, Jimi Hendrix played loud and free, Sergeant Pepper was real to me. Songs and poems were all you needed. Which way did the 60s go? Now I'm on a thin desolation row, and where I'm going I hardly know. It surely wasn't like this before, but oh, every time I look around, I feel so low, my head seems underground. Well, every day just seems to bring back
Go figure why I choose what I choose, but that was Al Stewart from Past, Present, and Future, and post-World War II blues. Nice, nice. Big thanks to David going out. He has reduced our deficit by down to $180. Thank you very, very kindly, our pal, the Angry Architect. Got an angry Indian and angry architect. Thank you. Thank you, David. I got no clue about these. Marty's told me, Randy's told me, Jack's told me, and other people are saying, "Hey, everything's fine." So Marty tells me, he said, I've had a couple of hiccups that have dropped me from the horn to KPFA. I listen to the MP3 stream using iTunes. Oh, okay, so it's just defaulting down to one of Marty's streams in his playlist. Okay, so, all right. Yeah, Norman Gold, yeah, that's probably it. But I don't know why the stream's glitching. Because other folks, Darcy has told me that everything stayed solid for him, and Asa says that it's fine his way, too. Go figure. But I have sent a note out to Ben Birch, who took a day off from work today because he was just allergied out the gazoo, so I've ruined him. Well, you know. Then again, hopefully the Claritin kicked in, and maybe he's not even conscious, so cool. Let's see. Let us go straightway back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
How are you?
I'm well, Jim. How are you?
Pretty good, I guess. Pursuant to something Bill mentioned about Maximilian in Mexico, I think he's been sort of maligned by history. You know, Louis Napoleon was behind the Treaty of Miramar, which basically stated that there had been a plebiscite in Mexico, in which they wanted to have the encomenderos, or the wealthy landowners, take their land back. And, of course, there were only 85 of these people. And there were, like, 5 or so million of Mexicans who had voted who couldn't even read or write. And so, basically, due to adventurism among the encomenderos or the Mexican noblemen who wanted to get their land back that had been taken from them.
Yeah, rather like the modern-day 1%.
Yeah. And so, Maximilian was lured to come in and thought that he was being given a genuine request by Mexico to be ruled by a king or an emperor. And he took the bait. He left his beautiful home at Miramar. It's one of the most beautiful places in the world on the Dalmatian coast. But nonetheless, he and his wife Carlotta came over, and they discovered, much to their chagrin, that the plebiscite had been a complete falsehood.
And they'd been sold a bill of goods.
Exactly. And Maximilian initially wanted to have some type of rule in which the people would have a voice. But there were just many problems between Maximilian and Juarez, who was, of course, the leader of the opposition. And due to bad advice, and I guess mistakes on his own part, maybe the insistence of Carlotta, his wife, he stayed. And he stayed there permanently. Well, not permanently. He was taken back for burial. But, I mean, it's just another example of adventurism into a country under false pretenses.
That makes sense, absolutely.
But
Maximilian was, I mean, he wasn't much of an adventurer in the first place, was he?
Well, he was just an archduke who had no place to go or no place to rule. They considered several candidates, but I think two of them were Protestant and one was Catholic. There's a great movie out. It's very, very historically accurate, called Juarez, starring Paul Mooney and Betty Davis. If you haven't seen that movie, you ought to. It's a great film.
I have not.
Juarez, and of course, Maximilian being led by, or misled by, French generals and things of that nature, encouraged him to take a heavier hand, which further distanced himself from the people, and all of a sudden, the American consul in Paris told Louis Napoleon, you better get the hell out of there, because our civil war is over. That's what Louis Napoleon took advantage of, was the fact that Americans were fighting the civil war, and he had banked on the fact that the Confederacy was going to win.
Another bum horse.
Yeah, and after Gettysburg, that's when things really began to fall apart for Maximilian, because he realized, number one, he'd been duped. Number two, the Confederacy would not win the war, and number three, that he and Juarez were totally irreconcilable. And that's what happened to him. His wife, Carlotta, now there are many theories about this, and as I may have said before, there's a great book called The Crown of Mexico. I can't remember the author. I read it many years ago. But his wife went back to Europe trying to get help for her husband because the French troops had been withdrawn or were being withdrawn. And she went totally mad. Now, there's some rumor that she had been given some mushrooms or something like that by some people. And maybe her sanity wasn't that firmly founded in the first place, but she went totally nuts and finally ended up in the Vatican, and she wouldn't eat or do anything. And she thought she was going to be poisoned. And she got so hungry that she even plunged her hand into a pot of boiling stew and suffered terrible burns.
Oh, Jesus.
But nonetheless, she was taken to a castle in the Netherlands called Stockerziel or whatever. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. And she remained there for the rest of her life. And they would let her out to go in a little boat around the moat. And when she would get into the boat, she would flash back in her mind and say, "Today we leave for Mexico."
Oh, I'm ready for my close-up, Max.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, William L. Shirer in Berlin Diary mentions when he went in as a correspondent with the Americans with the German army, even went into the place where she had been kept, and there was still notepaper from the former Habsburgs bearing their royal title and everything. Zita, or I think the woman's name was, or what, an empress who had been one of the successors. I think Karl was the last Habsburg after Franz Joseph died. But it's really interesting, you know, that he could go in there and find that stuff. And, of course, the occupants who had been the former Habsburgs had fled because of the onset of the von Manstein's Panzers that were just rolling right across, right through, you know, right where the hinge of the old Maginot line was and wasn't. And so it's just amazing history and the things that you can learn about it. But I've always had a sort of a special place in my heart for Maximilian. And I just wish he'd stayed in that beautiful place that he had called Miramar, View of the Sea. But he was duped, misled. Like I said, more adventurism, lies, things of that nature.
Well, I appreciate the backgrounder.
Okay.
And well, I think we all do.
Well, very good.
All right. Well, Jim, have yourself a very good evening.
You too, sir.
All right. We'll talk soon.
Bye.
Bye. Our buddy Jim calling from not too far away. He's a wellspring of information, Jim is. 15 minutes past the hour. Thank you to Sal, who is there just about every evening. Thank you very kindly, Sal. We're down to $175 to go to get out of the little hole that we've gotten ourselves in. Hopefully we will do that sooner rather than later, because it'll go up by the usual $150 tomorrow evening. And a reminder, we will have Friday on the front porch tomorrow evening. There's a story out there that I feel, I just talk about thorns in the side, Jesus, kind of begs to be gotten to. It's a story that centers around a climate scientist by the name of Jason Box. And it also centers around, well, things you never dreamed of seeing or knowing about on this planet. I remember as a kid and even as a young adult reading stories about, oh, say, the moons of Saturn or the moons of Jupiter, where there are seas of frozen methane gas. And I never really thought about us having those ourselves, but Daggummit, we do. And all of a sudden, here, now that I'm a 51-and-a-half-year-old human being, I'm finding out that having seas of frozen methane or patches or pockets of frozen methane can be very bad for the planet. And so it was that Dr. Jason Box, who comes from Colorado but emigrated over to Denmark where he could do his climate science without being constantly harassed and harangued by people paid by the American Petroleum Institute or the Friends of Coal or anything like that, you know, very well-funded denial industry that exists in these here United States. Jason Box went over to Denmark to continue his research, and his particular area of expertise is, in fact, methane. Seafloor methane. Methane trapped beneath the permafrost, which ain't perma or frost anymore. And so it was that Jason Box was made aware of a discovery that was announced this week by a number of scientists who make a habit of studying the planet. And what they discovered was that vast methane plumes are escaping from the seafloor of the Arctic Ocean. It was researchers at Stockholm University who described the vast methane plumes escaping from the seafloor. Methane, by the way, traps heat in the atmosphere oodles more effectively than even CO2 does. Well, see, that means we ain't got a CO2 problem. I hate these little weirdos that live in my head. So Jason Box has published quite a bit, as is noted at the website Motherboard at Vice.com, motherboard.vice.com. And knowing what he knows, which is vastly more than most of us do, Dr. Jason Box, I am presuming he is a doctor, he's a professor of glaciology. I don't think there's probably a lot of... There probably haven't been, but will be in the future, as long as we've got glaciers. There will probably be more people, more four-year-olds saying, I want to be a glaciologist. But that's what Jason Box is, and he took to his Twitter upon reading about the vast methane plumes escaping from the Arctic Ocean seafloor. And he tweeted simply and succinctly, if even a small fraction of Arctic seafloor carbon is released to the atmosphere, and methane is made of carbon, okay, just being clear here. If even a small fraction of Arctic seafloor carbon is released to the atmosphere, we're effed. And that's F apostrophe D. And that's what he said. That's a direct quote from his Twitter. If even a small fraction of Arctic seafloor carbon is released to the atmosphere, we're effed. The Arctic seafloor methane story freaked him the F out. They do not have, as the motherboard story notes, they do not have an exact answer. All right, Irish Dave, you say methane, the Brits say methane. Yeah, let's call the whole thing off. Aluminium, damn it. Now, the scientists being scientists are not prone to saying this is 100% certain until it is proven to be 100% certain. But the climate scientists, the climate scientists aren't certain that bullshit. The Earth didn't just spontaneously start belching out its pockets of methane. And climate scientists speculate that a warmer tongue of ocean current is destabilizing methane hydrates on the Arctic slope. So, over at Motherboard, the author of this article, Brian Merchant, a senior editor there, motherboard.vice.com, picked up the phone and called Copenhagen. He writes, first of all, I asked Dr. Box if he stood by that tweet. He did. He'd revise it a bit to include surface carbon, methane locked in the permafrost that's also beginning to leak out, because if we loose enough of either, we're in trouble. I'm sure you've been following the stories of the big holes in the ground opening up in Siberia, where the permafrost is melting. Apparently, the permafrost provided a sort of cap to keep the methane in, and without being ignited, there's enough pressure on the methane that causes it to just simply blow through the melted permafrost and leave these great gaping holes. Look, swimming pools! No. This planet is not supposed to be warm enough at that level for there to be swimming pools in the freaking Siberian tundra. But the upshot is that methane is far worse in terms of creating global warming than is CO2, and CO2 is a big enough problem. On the phone call, in the interview, Dr. Box said, even if a small fraction of the Arctic carbon were released to the atmosphere, we're fucked. He was particularly alarmed by the methane bubbles were reaching the surface. He said, that was something new in my survey of methane bubbles. The conventional thought is that the bubbles would be dissolved before they reached the surface and that microorganisms would consume that methane, and that's normal. But if the plumes are making it to the surface, that's a brand new source of heat-trapping gases that we need to worry about. Ulf Hedman is the science coordinator at the Swedish Polar Research Secretariat, and Ulf Hedman said, we are sniffing methane. We see the bubbles on video from the camera mounted on the CTD or the multicorer. All analysis tells the signs. We are in a mega flare. We see it in the water column. We read it above the surface, and we follow it high up into the sky with radars and lasers. We see it mixed in the air and carried away with the winds. Methane in the air. Methane is more than 20 times more potent than CO2 in trapping infrared as part of the natural greenhouse effect. Methane getting to the surface, that's potent stuff. This is all from Dr. Box. We're in a bind. We're in a bad bind. And we're in a bad bind that is being made worse because money. Because it is probably arguably true that the Koch brothers have enough money to build themselves some sort of little bubble community and get it staffed by peons who will work for pennies, lest they be cast out the bubble and wind up in some sort of bizarre Mad Max meets Logan's Run situation where Peter Ustinov ain't on the Capitol steps petting a cat. Everybody's dead. The Koch brothers probably do, and several other billionaires probably do, your Chris Kleins and your Jim Justices, they've got enough. They've probably got enough to survive, and they'll probably keep a few of us around just to make sure that somebody washes the goddamn shrimp forks. But they don't have enough money to support us all, nor are they inclined so to do, because after all, they're libertarians. They're followers of Ayn Rand. And, well, you know, that whole altruism thing is just stupid. Box said in the interview, again, motherboard.vice.com, I may escape a lot of this, but my daughter might not. She's 3 years old. You do understand what Box means by I may escape a lot of this. He means he'll be dead. He means that he doesn't expect within the natural, normal lifespan of a human being to see a lot of this, but he's pretty sure that his three-year-old daughter will. And if you have brought little humans onto this planet, if you have helped to create little humans on this planet, being dead before the fiddle player bill comes due is precious little in the way of consolation. My grandchildren, Agnes, our grandchildren are 7, 6, and 4. And this isn't going to be some sort of fundy tribulation where Jesus comes down at the end of it all on his holy rolls, orders the fundies to slaughter the Jews, and then everything is frisbees and wheat checks. It isn't going to work that way. No, no. No, we're talking about Mad Max and Lord of the Flies and not that happy Star Trek future. We're talking about a world where the dynamic model becomes not the Swedish social welfare state, which I admire, but Haiti and Somalia on steroids. Honest to Jesus, do you think that the American people are going to behave well when the shit finally does hit the fan? Oh, sure, after 100 years of abuse in Appalachia, a lot of people here sit on their hands and say, well, they've been shitting on us for 100 years. I guess we can take another turd or two. But that's because some of those people are being given a good bit of bread with which to surround the shit and make the shit sandwich that they eat every day. But when it really gets ugly, when the cable goes out, when the shelves are as empty as they were in Charleston and Toledo of clean, fresh, drinkable water, when the frackers have poisoned all the waters, when the mountaintop removers and the coal industry and the open pit miners and the gold miners and the copper miners and the iron miners have poisoned every last drop of water in this country, and the only way you can have any of your own is if you buy it at the store from some godforsaken corporation, and the shelves are empty, people will stop being nice. And we will not, as a people, as a country, the United States, will not be all stiff upper lip and chin up and pip pip and, you know, quiet desperation. Oh, hell no. We got a bunch of spoiled, rotten babies out there with a shitload of guns. And it'll be Katie bar the door. Now, see, if this was a for-profit operation, I would immediately move to an ad for, oh, I don't know, freeze-dried lasagna. But the appropriate response to this is not to start hoarding freeze-dried lasagna. The appropriate response to this is to do something about the essential problem. Dr. Box says I may escape a lot of this, but my daughter might not. She's 3 years old. On the other hand, I'm the one who argues that the fundamental problem we have on this planet is that our lives are too short to begin with so that we cannot learn any lessons. Our lives are so short that the absolute damn instant that the generation that saw the beginning of Social Security died off, the Republicans started going after Social Security because everybody had forgot how poverty-stricken this country was before it came in. And now the generation that saw the beginnings of Medicare is gone or going. So they're after that too. This is just a long con. We're being set up. And the only thing we can do is to try to fix the problem, not hoard freeze-dried lasagna. Box continued in this motherboard article, "We're on a trajectory to an unmanageable heating scenario, and we need to get off it. We're fucked at a certain point, right? It just becomes unmanageable. The climate dragon is being poked, and eventually the dragon becomes pissed off enough to trash the place." And I remember the name of the website that Grant turned us all on to, Nature Bats Last. And when it gets to that point, we're going to be lobbing grapefruit-sized softballs up at nature, and nature's going to be parking them in the cheap seats. But then he comes to this. If you stand to lose everything, and this is how the article ends. If you stand to lose everything, then even a low probability event is high risk. Got that? Even a low probability event is high risk. And the higher the risk, well, the more you're unprepared for its outcome. If you stand to lose everything, then even a low probability event is high risk. That's why people fund armies, just in case they get invaded. We, Box says, need to invest in decarbonizing our energy system. He paused, then added, "We've got to keep this fucking carbon in the ground." And see, that is the essential problem that we're dealing with right now. Think of any attempt at dealing with climate change that you can bring to mind. How about CO2 emissions regs? Doesn't that deal with carbon dioxide post the ignition source? Think about emissions regs for automobiles, trains, boats, planes, such as they are. That's all an attempt to deal with carbon post-ignition, or at the very most, at the ignition source. Even the very nature of trying to bring wind and solar online. By the way, I was not able to verify it, but I saw some reference to the idea that the Chinese are saying, screw it, we're not burning any more coal after like 2026 or something. Yeah, that's very true, Irish Dave. Not only does nature bat last, nature always bats 1,000. Nature never strikes out. Hell, nature never even gets a base on balls. Because that doesn't count as an at-bat now, does it? Okay, we're lost in the baseball statistical esoteric weeds. I apologize. But every single remedy, legislative or administrative, that I have seen has dealt with climate change at ignition or after. carbon storage, carbon capture and sequestration. Well, we're still going to generate the CO2, but we're going to turn on the Knuton valve and let it hyperventilate the flagellate, and then we'll be able to pump all the CO2 in a compressed cold form down underneath the earth, where it will not behave like other gases always behave according to the laws of science and nature, but will instead remain quiescent and well-behaved. Because magic, money, hope, prayer. Only it won't. Once again, dealing with CO2 and carbon generally at or after ignition. And so I kind of jumped and said, Eureka! And yes, when I read Jason Bach saying we've got to keep this fucking carbon in the ground. Natural processes don't necessarily have to have consciousness in order to be elegant or functional. The earth itself found a way to sequester carbon. That's what coal is. That's what natural gas is. That's what shale gas is. That's what crude oil is. It is sequestered carbon that the earth found a way of putting away so that the earth could be a different kind of earth instead of Venus or Mars or the frozen methane wastes of some Jovian moon or Saturnine satellite. Tell me, and I would be happy to hear it. Send it to me in an email. Call on the phone. Send me a tweet. Give me one example. Because one is all I've got. Give me one example of, in Jason Box's words, keeping this fucking carbon in the ground. I got one example. There aren't any laws to stop tar sands extraction in Alberta. There's damn sure no laws to stop tar sands extraction in Utah or Alabamistan. There are no laws of which I am aware to stop fracking altogether, except for a few moratoria in communities in New York. Remember, activists in southern Illinois wanted to stop fracking altogether, wanted a moratorium until more could be known and studied. And the Sierra Club said, no, 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 you grassroots on the ground rubes. We're going to craft fracking laws for you, and we're going to partner with the fracking industry to do it. There are precious few bans on coal extraction. The Obama administration is leasing out coal lands for all public lands, BLM lands, for all it's worth. For coal mining. Again, the mild, tepid, even weak EPA CO2 regs only deal with carbon post-ignition. There's one lonely little bill sitting in the House of Representatives in this miserably ineffective, cynical 113th Congress. One bill. H.R. 526. Titled the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. And that bill, based upon principles of science and scientific inquiry, seeks, in the words of Jason Box, to keep this fucking carbon in the ground. I'm working on something right now. I don't know if it'll go anywhere. I'm working on a domestic export ban of coal. We have a domestic export ban of crude oil. Why not coal? Why not? Note coming in from Bill in Helena, Montana. Bob, I saw this the other day on Common Dreams and thought about you and the folks in West Virginia. The video with the article is 36 minutes of a helicopter ride over hell. But everybody needs to see what's being done everywhere there is gold, copper mining, not to mention coal. This is the reason the pebble mine in Bristol Bay, Alaska, needs to be stopped before it gets started, and mountaintop removal needs to be banned. And a link, with great sorrow, Bill in Helena, Montana. Yeah, we talked about that last night, Bill. But seeing it is visceral. Go to commondreams.org. Massive environmental disaster, Canada, toxic tailing pond floods waterways. And remember, that tailing pond, that sea of toxic waste, is 1/7 the size of what's in the Brushy Fork impoundment. Roughly 1/7 the size of what's in the Brushy Fork impoundment outside Whitesville, West Virginia. Sure wish the U.S. government would do a study on the Brushy Fork impoundment and the Shoemate Dam and any of the other 100 impoundments in the state of West Virginia and report back on what a looming disaster they are. But hillbillies don't merit the same solicitude that the blasted landscape we created in Iraq does. So I think nice, Sparky. Sparky's imagining right-wing headlines. Lib Talker wants war on coal exports. Yeah, I kind of do. You see, the war on coal is a made-up bunch of baloney. I'd like to have a real one. It wouldn't be, though, when you get right down to it, it wouldn't be a war on coal. It would be a war of self-defense of the entire human race. Nope. Check that. Not race. Race is another bullshit concept. A war in self-defense of the entire human species. How's that? Jan and Jerry in Vegas wanting to know, have any representatives signed on recently to the AIC Act? No. No, they haven't. Because at this point in time, the 113th Congress is just moaning and groaning to its miserable, shameful end. It also has not been introduced in the Senate. And that's partially our fault. Not yours, but mine and Bo's and others, the AIC campaign's fault. Why is that? Because we're broke. Dead, flat, broke. The eight campaign headquarters in Washington, D.C. are gone. Moved out. We can't afford a night in a Super 8 40 miles out in Manassas, Virginia, to go up and work the halls of Congress like we did before. You know, all during the program, I get notifications as emails roll in and whatnot. And I just got one from our friends at Americans Against the Tea Party. And maybe I'm just in a cranky mood, but it pisses me off. Chris Christie's approval rating in the toilet hits 3-year low. Who gives a damn? I mean, I'm sorry. To our listeners in Jersey, I'm sorry. You know he's an asshole. I know he's an asshole. Everybody knows Chris Christie is an asshole. There is more misery and destruction and death on this little planet than this little planet has seen in rather a long time. You know, at least 60 years or so. 70. Wasn't yesterday the 69th anniversary of the United States dropping the first nuclear bomb on an innocent civilian population? Why, yes, yes it was. Yeah, I don't care. I really don't. I don't care much about Chris Christie. Just don't. But I care an awful lot about the human species. I am admittedly anthropophilic. I dig humanity. With all of our flaws and all of our misery and all of our meanness. Well, it's kind of like that Robert Frost poem, happiness makes up in height for what it lacks in length. No matter how awful we as human beings can be, we are capable of grand, magnificent moments of beauty and genius and compassion and learning and study and inquiry. And I don't want that to go away. And yeah, 100 years tops. That's it. That's the best you get. Ain't too many people get further than that in those last few years, unless you're very fortunate, don't have a lot of quality in them. I've said before that if I had it to do over again, I think when our little ones were born, I don't know, maybe it would have been abusive, but as soon as they could comprehend, start telling them, this ride is very short. It seems like it's not to you now, but please, for the love of God, believe me, this ride is short. You got to make it all count every day. I mean, the way I am, I realized something the other day. You know, if I was allowed to live to the great age of the mythological Methuselah, even as that time wound down, I'd be saying, wait, I want to see more. I want to know more. Because it's magnificent. This planet is magnificent. Sure, there's probably other life somewhere out in the universe. It is almost statistically impossible that there isn't. But this is what we know. This is all we know. This is all the contact that we have amongst ourselves. And when you realize that, you kind of just want to soak it in like a sponge. And the world to come, eternity, the world after, paradise, wings, halos, bullshit. Not interested. I like here. I'm a homebody. Where Earth is home. And I think part of the problem we have in this country is we, in this country, and some others, hi Australia, we don't have enough homebodies. We don't have enough people wandering around looking at the world, whether it be an urban cityscape of massive skyscrapers or ancient pyramids rising out of a jungle, or the babble of a brook in the middle of a bunch of shade trees. We don't have enough people wandering around going, this is cool. I want to stay here forever. When I was a little boy, I thought, ooh, it'd be cool to go to the moon. Then you learn about the moon, and it's not a very nice place. Mars? Mars doesn't look very nice at all. There's been a really, really cool recent development in terms of propulsion by the NASA lab up in Cleveland. Frank sent me that article the other day, and I just went, wow. Wow. But anything outside this little pale blue dot, thank you, Dr. Sagan, is a crapshoot taken on no information. And if we begin to understand it within those parameters, then leaving this fucking carbon in the ground becomes a no-brainer. The only way leaving the carbon in the ground isn't a viable alternative is if the only thing we think of and the first thing we think of is corporate profits. And just as once upon a time, several times, hundreds of times, thousands of times throughout the rise of humanity, we have dropped old technologies in favor of newer, better ones. We got to be doing that now, yesterday. And instead, we can talk to each other for hours on end about whether an alcoholic Speaker of the House has the right to sue the President of the United States. By the way, if you want to find out about the new propulsion drive, it's called the CANNAE drive, CANNAE, The Verge, TheVerge.com, TheVerge.com. NASA tested an impossible space engine, and it somehow worked. Oh, cool. It's just a little bitty experiment. The story is dated August 1st, and it says, At a conference in Cleveland, Ohio, scientists with NASA's Eagle Works Laboratories in Houston, Texas, presented a paper indicating they had achieved a small amount of thrust from a container that had no traditional fuels, only microwaves bouncing around inside of it. If it can be tested all the way outward, it could result in an ultra-lightweight, ultra-fast spacecraft that could carry humans to Mars in weeks instead of months. Oh, great, Mars. I mean, it's fascinating, right? Mars needs Republicans. There was a question in the chat room earlier about whether we should make climate change deniers take a course in basic science. And no, hell no. You can teach him, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him mow your lawn. We don't need to give Republicans a basic class in science. We need to move the dumb bastards to Siberia or the Maldive Islands and let them holler about climate change being a hoax as the water comes up over their chin, or hoax as the hole opens up in the Siberian permafrost. Just a little ray of sunshine wrapping up this Thursday, Thorn in the Side Thursday. Thank you, Thomas. Thank you very kindly for kicking in. And thank you. Thank you to Robert. Thank you very kindly. We are now down to $160 to go. We're just $10 away from finishing up yesterday's fundraising, which is awesome. Thank you, one and all. Time to get out of here. Friday on the front porch tomorrow, by golly. I'm looking forward to it. I hope you are too. That little tiny bill that actually addresses the root cause of climate change, it's got the support it does because of the work you've done. You're not sitting around on your hands. You're not sitting around working on meaningless stuff. You're taking action, and I thank you. And you can give yourself a pat on the back, and we can all give ourselves a little bit of applause for that. Thank you for everything you've done for the AIC Act. Don't give up, because this is the kind of thing upon which the future of humanity itself depends. Implementation of the precautionary principle as is embodied in the AIC Act. Keeping the carbon in the ground as it is embodied in the AIC Act. You have helped make that happen. You have at least brought that into the purview of government. We have not succeeded yet, but you have done that. And that means you're out in front of the curve. You're doing things that other people aren't doing. Bill McKibben isn't busting his ass to pass the AIC Act. You are. That means you're doing something concrete. Real. The Sierra Club isn't busting its ass to pass the AIC Act. You are. The Natural Resources Defense Council isn't doing the goddamn thing to pass the AIC Act. You are. And you deserve to be proud of that. So thanks, everybody. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to all of you who keep this effort going. Thank you first and most to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and yes, AIC Act, AICHEACT.ORG. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night.